From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Excelsior.
West Portal.
Potrero Hill.
I'm from the Bayview.
Coming up, we talk with local journalist Shane Bauer about reporting undercover as a border militiaman.
They're always kind of talking about how the past was better. Of course, when they're talking about a better past, they're talking about a past for white guys.
We'll also discuss the state of journalism under the president-elect.
It's frightening, you know. I mean, this is definitely the first election in my life that I have ever thought about how a president will affect my job.
Then we meet some bikers showing up to support victims of child abuse.
I mean, you're talking about big old guys with tattoos and stuff sitting there coming back with, you know, cat faces painted on them or, you know, their fingernails painted.
Defying expectations today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Mother Jones reporter Shane Bauer has spent time in an Iranian prison. He's gone undercover as a prison guard at a maximum security prison in Louisiana. And most recently, he embedded with militiamen patrolling the U.S.-Mexico border. For his body of work, the Oakland-based reporter was named Journalist of the Year last week by the Society of Professional Journalists of Northern California. I sat down with him in studio to talk about his latest report, going undercover as a border militiaman. After first training in California, Shane Bauer went to join an Arizona militia.
I just pulled in and, you know, asked where to set up my tent and just set up a tent and then sat around the fire. And it didn't take too long before people start going out on operations. They would leave the base.
And, so there was like a set schedule? And
I mean, it would basically be when the commander would kind of rally everyone up and say, okay, here's the plan. He would kind of sit in his camper planning operations, and then he'd come out and tell people what we're going to do. So we do things in the daytime, also in the middle of the night. And, you know, sometimes we're combing through the desert near the border. Sometimes we're setting up on mountains, looking for people.
Looking for people.
Yeah.
So what were you, who are you looking for?
For people crossing the border, people entering the country illegally, basically drug smugglers or just immigrants.
So this is what they thought their mission was.
Yeah, they talk a lot about drug smugglers, although, you know, they're after anybody who's crossing the border. And, you know, a lot of these guys are very conspiratorially minded. And, you know, I saw times that we, you know, would go past a Latino-looking person and who looks at us or something, and, you know, they would say, oh, that guy's a spotter for the cartel. And it's like everybody who is brown around there gets kind of wrapped into their idea that they're cartel and they're after the militia.
Mm. So you mentioned in the article that 3UP encountered both uniformed policemen and Border Patrol who seemed not to care too much. They kind of turned a blind eye to the militia members. What was that relationship like between the militia and law enforcement and, you know, folks who this is their real job?
Yeah, that was what surprised me most about this whole experience was seeing their relationship with the Federal Border Patrol. Not only did the Border Patrol tolerate them, but they kind of used them in a sense. I saw a long interaction between the leaders of the militia and a Border Patrol agent who said that he was an intelligence officer in the area. And he was telling us where we should go, you know, where we should set up. He took us on a long drive and told us where to set up. And they were showing up at the base all the time. You know, they would bring us donuts. They you know, said repeatedly, you know, we really like having you guys down here. And the fact is that the militia outmanned and outgunned the Border Patrol in the area by far. That really surprised me. I mean, I thought if anything, the Border Patrol might kind of be just tolerating them and kind of letting them be there. But it did surprise me how much they were actively working with the militia.
Mm-hmm. Was this really genuinely only about the drug cartels and people because they're crossing the border illegally? Or did you feel that there was something more in the way they, maybe the way they spoke about people trying to cross the border, the language that they used? And you can curse, we'll bleep.
Okay. The militia officially says that it's, you know, does not allow racism. And militias generally, they're not, they don't consider themselves white supremacists. They're kind of a slightly different world. But, you know, there was a lot of racism, I mean, in the camp. People using the N-word, people talking about hunting Mexicans.
If I can interrupt, and not just Mexicans and the N-word. There, at some point, one of them had a joke to tell. How do you tell a Jew from a Slav? You can't. They're both ashes.
Right.
And so it's everybody. It feels like that covers a number of groups of people.
Yeah.
That they don't like.
And not, you know, I wouldn't say that all of these guys that are there are saying those kind of things, but nobody is trying to, you know, call anyone out for anything.
Did that joke get laughs?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's the idea of, you know, the worst thing you can be in this far right world is offended by anything. You know, so if you're telling somebody, hey, don't say that, then you're, you know, they have this kind of idea that you're being like Big Brother, the PC police or something. And, you know, so people just kind of let anything go.
So you absorbed all of the hate.
Yeah.
What was that like?
I mean, I just kind of, mostly just kind of kept to myself, and I would just sit there and listen.
So can you tell me about some of these operations?
Mm-hmm. You know, these operations varied. There was one time that I went out with a couple guys, and they were called Iceman and Sandstone. They all use these kind of call signs for security. And
your name was?
They start calling me Cali, so that became my name.
Cali as in California?
I was the only person from California, so I stood out a little bit.
Uh-huh. You didn't bring any kale with you, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Although there was one time that there was this little snack box, and I grabbed some chips, and somebody had to point out that I was eating the plain. I was the only person that was eating the plain Sun Chips in the group.
Ooh.
So... You know, it can be really bizarre. I mean, we're walking through these sand washes, and one of the guys points to the ground kind of dramatically and says, look, and, you know, I'm looking and I don't see anything. And the other guy is like, oh, a footprint. And I don't see a footprint, but the guy says it's a moccasin print. So, you know, we're walking through the desert looking at these, following these prints that I can't see. And one of the guys is carrying a sword. And
a sword.
Yeah. We did this for a long time, and eventually we came upon some bundles of clothing and food and water, presumably that had been left by some humanitarian groups for people crossing through the desert. And these guys stabbed the water jugs, poured all the water out, destroyed all the food. The guy who was kind of the lead guy, you know, told us don't tell anybody I did this. But later that night, one of the ranking militiamen, you know, instructed all of us that if we find anything, we should destroy it. And the phrase he used was deny the enemy.
Deny the enemy.
Yeah.
So these people sound like they're ready to kill, if that wasn't clear so far. When you talk to them, how do they explain how they have a right to be there armed, ready to kill folks? And do they think about the repercussions of that?
Well, I think they would say that they're not out there to kill people, and that they would only fire if somebody shot at them. But the way that they describe... Generally, the way that militias describe, the legality of what they do is that they call themselves militias because they're claiming that they're the same as the militias from Revolutionary War time, which there are laws still on the books from that time, and they, you know, see themselves as continuing this kind of tradition of kind of grassroots. They're kind of these grassroots groups providing defense against the federal government.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We're talking to Shane Bauer, senior reporter at Mother Jones, about his latest article, Undercover with a Border Militia. We're at a time right now where a lot of people are thinking about kind of the other and how they think and people's experiences, who you might not be in touch with on a daily basis, mm-hmm. living in a bubble.
Yeah.
What do you think people should understand about these militiamen you spent time with that mm-hmm. would be beneficial to that conversation?
These are guys who, you know, whether this is right or wrong, they see themselves as victims in society. They are mostly working class white men, although not totally. Sometimes you'll see one or two people of color in the groups. And a lot of them are military veterans who are looking, in many cases, for something that gives them a sense of what they had in the military. And they feel that, you know, I got the sense that they felt pretty alienated back home. And I heard them kind of complaining a lot about the military leadership, and they have a kind of sense of frustration that once they're not serving, the military just kind of drops them by the wayside, and you know, they don't get the things they need from Veterans Affairs. Mm. And you know, it's easy for people like this to see Mexican immigrants as the enemy. You know, they think, well, I've making a lot less money than I did 15, 20 years ago. And the closest person I can see that's my competitor are immigrants. I think this kind of sense of victimization is very complex. And I think it's something that we need to be really exploring, because it's not only manifesting in the militias. And, you know, the way that they talk about things like Black Lives Matter, things they say about women, you know, I get the sense that for a lot of these guys, they feel they would not articulate it this way. But I think that there is a feeling that they're losing power that they had previously, you know, being white men, and they don't like that, you know. And when they're talking about a better past, they're talking about a past for white guys, you know.
So you understood where they were coming from. Did you feel empathy with them at all?
I mean, sure. Yeah. I think on some level, I felt empathy. I didn't feel empathy with the fact that they're running around the desert looking for Mexicans. I mean, I didn't feel empathy for, you know, their racism or misogyny. But, you know, they generally are people that don't have a lot, you know, and they're mostly poor. And I empathize with that.
As a journalist, how has the election of Donald Trump affected how you think about your work?
I think it's a scary time for journalists. I mean, you know, we're, in a sense, it feels like we're entering a kind of post-truth world where, you know, the country's going to be led by somebody who doesn't seem to really distinguish between fact and fiction. And he, you know, was brought to power to some extent from people reading fake news websites, conspiracy theories. It's frightening, you know, to think. So my job is to show people, you know, facts or just the truth about something. What does that mean now?
That's reporter Shane Bauer. He was named Journalist of the Year last week by the Society of Professional Journalists of Northern California. You can find a link to his latest work at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Child trauma, including child abuse and neglect, is one of the most significant public health issues we face in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Social workers, educators, law enforcement, courts, and nonprofits all work on a daily basis to prevent child abuse. But there's another organization that takes a very unique approach to addressing child abuse and filling in the gaps, and it happens to be one of the largest motorcycle organizations in the world. KALW's Bonnie Chan has the story.
On a recent Tuesday evening, the parking lot of a pizza restaurant in Sunnyvale is filled with gleaming rows of parked motorcycles, with more arriving every few minutes. Inside the pizza joint are the owners of those motorcycles. There are more than 30 people gathered, and they're all wearing black leather biker vests and jackets emblazoned with the same patch. A logo of a closed fist against a red background. They're all here for one reason, to talk about empowering children and preventing child abuse. This is the monthly meeting of the Silicon Valley chapter of Bikers Against Child Abuse, or BACA for short. They're a nonprofit organization that wants this sound to be the sound of safety for abused kids.
BACA is provided to help empower children of abuse not to be afraid of the world they're living in. And that's basically what we do. We'll do anything we can to help a kid through these dark times.
Haas is the vice president of the Silicon Valley chapter, but Haas isn't his real name. BACA members all go by nicknames for anonymity. Their work involves building supportive relationships with kids who have suffered abuse, and in some cases, standing guard outside their house to protect them from their perpetrators.
We'll take them for rides. And just, you know, hey, if they're scared in the middle of the night and they can't sleep, they give us a call, we'll be there. We'll sit in front of that house 24 hours a day until they feel safe.
Haas, by the way, is a big guy, and he knows it. He looks intimidating. But that's the kind of service BACA's providing to kids who feel unsafe, a sense of security. For Haas, protecting children is intensely personal.
Personally, me and my wife, we went through everything trying to have children and things wouldn't work. So children are real special to us, and I'll fight for one, you know, until the day I die. That's just the way it is.
BACA works within strict guidelines to protect the identities of the kids they work with. They never post photos or share any specifics about the families they're connecting with and don't allow recording of their encounters with kids. There is an exception that Haas will talk about, though, because the case made national headlines last year.
Out of the South Bay, where an escaped inmate is still on the loose. He was originally busted in a child abuse case.
Last March, an inmate named Janelle Carter escaped custody while being transferred from the Santa Clara County Jail to a medical center. BACA's Silicon Valley chapter had already been working with Carter's 9-year-old victim for a year. But with Carter's escape and the massive manhunt that followed, BACA got more involved.
Our goal is to just do whatever we have to do to make this family feel safe and to make this child feel safe.
BACA members stood guard outside the family's house for 4 weeks until Carter was rearrested in Mississippi.
That's the kind of things that we do. Take them to school, help the mom with the grocery shopping with the kid, you know, if they need that.
Haas says a typical first meeting with a kid goes something like this.
We'll just roll up with a bunch of members and we'll get off the bikes and we'll go up and we'll take a knee because I'm 6'5", so I'll take a knee and put myself down to their eye level.
They'll say hello and tell the kid where they're from.
We'll have members that come from all over, you know, and so this kid will look and go, you came from Sacramento to meet me here in San Jose? And yeah, you know, and you're in our family now, you know.
Then they welcome them into the BACA family by giving the kid their very own personalized jacket. Besides standing guard outside a child's home, BACA also accompanies kids to court when they testify against their abusers.
We'll put that kid in the middle of us and we'll walk them through court. They got to go to the bathroom. People take them to the bathroom.
BACA members stress that they work within the law. They get referrals from social workers and government agencies and only take on cases where the abuse has been reported to authorities. They will not show up at a kid's house unless the kid's guardian has asked them to be there, which means they can only intervene in situations where the perpetrator doesn't live in the same house as the child.
We're not vigilantes. We're not, you know, that's another problem people have if they think they can just join this and go beat up people. That's not what we're about.
Every member of BACA is screened through a federal background check, then goes through a training process that lasts more than a year. And there are always at least two bikers with a child at any time. That's been the case since 1996, when BACA was formed by a child therapist who loved motorcycles. Now BACA has chapters all over the world, and they do outreach in their surrounding communities. On a recent Sunday, I visit the Santa Clara Art and Wine Festival, where BACA is running a booth. Longtime member Joker is helping out there. He's been involved with BACA for 11 years.
We've got two motorcycles here that kids can actually sit on and we'll take their picture, print out the picture, and let them take it away as their own souvenir.
A biker named Sparkle is handing out pens and stickers to passerby.
One sticker or tattoo? Oh, I'll do a tattoo.
On Joker's business card, there's a photo of him. On it, he's clean cut and wearing a button-up shirt. But that's not what he looks like here. He's wearing a bandana and leather vest with tattoos running up his arms. He says it wouldn't be as effective if they showed up at a kid's house, wearing golf shirts, riding Vespas. That wouldn't be as intimidating. But at the end of the day, their job is to let kids paint their fingernails, not to fight abusers. So it's all about maintaining a balance. Ha says he'd do anything for a child he's protecting.
If I have to stand in front of that child and take a bullet, I'm going to do it. That's just the way it's going to be. There's no doubt in my mind that most of my brothers and sisters would do that. And I know I would.
Ha says this work is life-changing, but it's not meant to be a permanent relationship.
Well, we like to get to a process where we get done, you know, when everything's, when court's done or whatever, everything's done and they're empowered, we need to break away. We don't want them to feel that they need us forever.
Kind of like superheroes, they come. And when the job is done, they go. In Santa Clara, I'm Bonnie Chan for Cross Currents.
Our helpline had rang just the other day. Another child's innocence has been stripped away.
If you've got story ideas you'd like us to follow, be sure to tell us about them. Give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Our team today includes Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Olivia Henry, Jürgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, Claire Strempel, Ted Muldoon, and Beatrice Thomas. The show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Oakland band Zion Eye. You can hear them at the New Parish in Oakland on Friday night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
I've been feeling like my brain's cracked. Rainbow on these train tracks. Young gifted black. G my third, I tripped the slang back. Rotate with my strange pack. Your questions rang like Say Jack. I fell down and I came back. My crew down and my gang black. AOT automatically. Rest in purple majesty. Spirit rises casually, but first distrust your faculty. Salaries can sugarcoat untimely detonation. Don't be running like no guinea pig. Too much time forsaken. Why you waiting?
Said I need someone to tell.